Vaughan from Utrecht, and he is going to tell us about the canonical formalism for simplicial gravity. Philip?
Yep. Okay, hello everyone. I hope you can hear me. So the focus of this talk will be on some recent work that has been done in collaboration with Bianca Dittrich and how one can implement a very general and elementary evolution scheme for simplicial gravity into a canonical language. And you see the relevant references there in red. And it's also partially based on work in progress. Okay, so let's go to the next slide, slide two. I want to do that too, sorry. Okay, so here's the outline. So I'll begin with the motivation for why it would be interesting to have a general canonical framework. And I will also mention some of the challenges for it. Then I will go on in part two, we'll talk about a very general evolution scheme for simplicial gravity. Thereon, then in section three, I will tell you something about a canonical formalism which holds for general discrete systems, and we can in particular apply that then to simplicial gravity and implement then the evolution scheme of part two. And then afterwards, I hope I will have time for that, I will talk about constraints and symmetries that arise in this framework. And then finally, I want to conclude and maybe have a brief outlook on also what happens in the quantum theory. Okay, let's go to slide three. Let me briefly recap some features of canonical general relativity. So the basic assumption is that here we work with a space-time manifold, which is globally hyperbolic, so that we have a topology of R times sigma, where sigma is some 3 manifold, so that we can perform a 3 plus 1 splitting. And then, as we all know, at least in the ADM formulation, the canonical pairs are given by the induced intrinsic metric QID on this hypersurface sigma, so which describes the intrinsic geometry of that hypersurface. And then this canonical partner, pi AB, is related to the extrinsic curvature and also contains the embedding information of that hypersurface into the full four-dimensional space-time. And then, of course, a very prominent role in this formalism is played by the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints, which form the hypersurface deformation algebra. And in the continuum, it is important that they actually generate both the symmetries and the time evolution. And they do that in such a way that hypersurfaces evolve in a multi-finger time through the full four-dimensional solution. And so, and the reason why I'm mentioning these well-known things here is because what we want to do in simplicial gravity is to construct an analogous structure, and where I underline analogous here because there are obviously some differences between the discrete and the continuum, and I will try to point out what the relevant differences are. Okay, so let's go to slide number four. So I'm not sure whether everyone is known as familiar with Regge calculus, so that's why I thought before everything here, we'll give a brief recap of Regge calculus, which is one way of discretizing GR. There's also other ways, of course. But yeah, so the basic idea here is from Regge in the 60s that one should go on and replace a smooth d-dimensional space-time manifold M with a metric G mu nu living on it by some piecewise linear flat metric living on a triangulation T, which is comprised of d-dimensional syntheses. So now we have to think about how one can describe the geometry of such a triangulation, and it turns out that, in fact, if we know all the lengths of all the edges in the triangulation, then we know the entire geometry of that triangulation, so these edge lengths really encode the complete geometry, and in the Regge calculus, these lengths of the edges are the configuration variables. Okay, so but one thing, I mean, we don't need to know many details here about Regge calculus, but what we definitely need to know for this talk is an action principle. At this stage, I probably should say that in the rest of this talk, we will work in Euclidean signature, simply to avoid some causal subtleties. Just note that the canonical formalism that I will construct also holds or goes through essentially in the same way for a Lorentzian signature, just that in the end, one will have to worry about some causality issues. But that's not what we want to do here, so we work in Euclidean signature. So, and then Regge taught us how to get a discretization of the Einstein-Hüther reduction. The Regge action is then given on the bottom part of that slide, basically by two terms, a bulk term and a boundary term. And essentially, the task is to translate that curvature term of the Ricci scalar into the discrete. And to this end, one should note that in triangulations, one can measure the curvature by so-called deficit angles. And deficit angles measure essentially the deviation from 2 pi of the sum of dihedral angles around the hinge. The hinge is a d-2 dimensional subsimplex in the triangulation. So in two dimensions, it's a vertex. In three dimensions, it's an edge. And in four dimensions, it's a triangle. And so these hinges, they carry the curvature, and so since it only the curvature only has support on the hinges, that's why essentially it is multiplied in the bulk term of the action with the volume of the hinge. So that's the AH there. So in the epsilon there is the deficit angle. So, okay, and then there's also a boundary term which looks very much the same, with the sole difference that now we don't have a deficit angle, but an extrinsic curvature angle, psi h, which measures the extrinsic curvature angle around the hinge in the boundary. So, and the nice feature about this action with the boundary term is, in fact, that it is additive, and it is additive in the sense that if we have two pieces of triangulation, we glue them together, then the Regge contribution, or the action contribution to the entire triangulation, then just given by the sum of the contributions of the individual parts. And so, and this is actually what will be relevant in the main part of this talk, and that's also when we talk about superficial gravity here, we refer specifically then to Regge calculus. Okay, so let's move on to slide five. So let's do the real motivation part now. Thus far, there have been mainly covariant formulations for superficial gravity, and especially in the covariant, in the quantum theory, has thereby benefited from the many numerical techniques that have been available from lattice gauge theories, and in particular in causal dynamical triangulations. One has produced some spectacular progress or advances on this. However, in general, a general canonical framework has been lacking for superficial gravity. And one of the major obstacles is what I shall call here the problem of foliations. And that is, of course, the question of how are we going to foliate a triangulation. And in fact, a generic triangulation will be such that if we choose some hypersurfaces in it, then different hypersurfaces will be comprised of different numbers of simplices. And now the simplices carry the variables. And remember that in the Regge calculus, now the configuration variables are the length of the edges. And so it means at different steps, we have different numbers of variables. And so in that sense, we actually need a mapping between phase spaces of different dimensions. So this is the challenge of constructing such a general framework for superficial gravity in canonical language. Okay, so let's move to slide number six. So there have been some previous attempts, of course. The initial ones in the 1980s started from using the continuum 3+1 splitting, and they then discretized space that is only the hypersurface of sigma, but they kept an infinitesimal time evolution generated by a set of constraints. And this, in fact, if we want to have a consistent canonical framework which is equivalent to the covariant formulation, then we, of course, want to reproduce the solutions of the covariant formalism, so those coming directly from the action. And this is clearly not given by this attempt in the 80s, because at the end of the time evolution, what we get is clearly not a four-dimensional triangulation. And so instead, what we really need is a discrete time evolution, which is not generated by constraints. And in fact, the time evolution will be generated by a set of discrete evolution moves. And in the main part of this talk, I will then mention what these discrete evolution moves are. And so then if we have constraints in such a framework, then the role of them is actually reduced to generating infinitesimal transformations, which under certain conditions correspond to gauge symmetries of the action, but they do not generate the time evolution. So this is really the difference between a discrete and a continuum here. Okay, so and then based on some early ideas, there has been recently the first consistent canonical formulation which for triangulations which reproduces covariant solutions. However, there has been one major drawback. And that is actually that the spatial triangulations were preserved. In fact, we were working with so-called tent moves. So, and instead, now let's go to slide number seven, please. Here in this talk, now we want to consider the general situation. In fact, the lattice or the spatial triangulation, in fact, can evolve or change in the course of evolution. And this is somewhat in spirit also as in loop quantum gravity, where we can have changing graphs in the course of evolution. In particular, if we think of a spin foam interpolating two hypersurfaces, then we may allow also for the graphs in the two hypersurfaces to be quite different. So, and in particular, this will mean that the numbers of degrees of freedom will vary from step to step, and that's what we have to incorporate in our formalism. So that's the challenge. And now, at this stage, I may then ask why would one bother at all to construct a general canonical formalism? There's some reasons why this may be it seems to be a promising endeavor. At least classically, this should provide us with a better notion of discrete dynamics and discrete time evolution. In fact, it should also it will allow us to capture the full space of discrete solutions. So in spirit, it is a bit like trying to obtain a covariant phase-space formalism for discrete systems. Then another reason is that it may be advantageous for several physical situations to be able to treat a growing lattice. For example, if one wants to treat an expanding or contracting universe, it may also be helpful for the numerical implementation. And as we will see in the course of this talk, some of these evolutions, they will actually just involve some updating processes, which in principle should be implementable on a computer. So, and then in quantum gravity, for us, interesting is also that, well, at least in state time models, we calculate transition amplitudes between three-dimensional geometry. And this picture is somehow not really complete unless we identify these states as some elements of Hilbert spaces of three geometries, which brings us back to the canonical picture. And another thing is that in the view of attempts to compare or at least connect different approaches to quantum gravity, for example, also loops and spin forms, it will also be interesting to have such a general canonical formalism for simplicial gravity, because what we will see at the end of this talk is we will get a formalism which is really equivalent to the covariant formalism, and that should also hold in the quantum theory. So, and then finally, this also bears a little on the question of whether in the end, ultimately, we will have a discrete time evolution also upon quantizing the Hamiltonian constraints. So whether the discrete evolution will rather be generated by some discrete evolution moves, or whether it really is a constraint with some continuous time evolution. And so at least for the regularized versions, for example, there's this version by Alessi and Mirovelli, which is understood to generate the 1-4 Pachner move. So I hope that by the end of this talk, I will have convinced you that we should also be considering other Pachner's in that respective dimension. Okay, so the goal of this talk is therefore to construct a general canonical scheme which is capable of reproducing essentially all triangulations. Okay, so then let's move to the main part of the talk. Let's move to slide number 8. So now I've told you that the time evolution, the free time evolution, will not be generated by any constraints, but instead by evolution moves, and I will now tell you what the evolution moves are in our scheme here. And so the basic idea is that we glue single d-dimensional simplices to a d-1 dimensional triangulated hypersurface, sigma k, we count every such elementary step by k. And may I please ask those of you who are sitting at the next button to now press this button 8 times in a row? So what you should see now is an illustration of what happens when we glue single simplices to such a triangulation. Then that hypersurface, in fact, evolves in a discrete multi-finger time through the full d-dimensional solution. So it is very very closely analogous to the situation in canonical general relativity. And of course, we can also have backward evolution by just removing some simplices. But here in this talk, I want to focus on the moves. So now it turns out that if we want to implement such moves, then that requires the action to be additive. And we saw that this action for Rege calculus is additive. So, and that's why when we apply this to simplicial gravity, we will first of all do this for Rege calculus. Okay, let's move on to slide number 9. So the nice feature of these gluing moves is that they actually have a nice interpretation within the hypersurfaces themselves. So what you should be seeing here is now the three-dimensional example of gluing a single tetrahedron onto a single triangle. And so please press next now. So now you should be seeing the two-dimensional perspective of this gluing procedure. So what happens is that the central triangle in the hypersurface sigma k gets subdivided into three new triangles at step k plus 1. And so the new vertex is just corresponds to the tip of the tetrahedron that has been glued in that process. So and this is what is called a 1-3 Pachner move. And now it turns out that all the other Pachner moves in 3D and 4D and also actually other dimensions can be obtained by similar gluing moves. And we will consider the other Pachner moves later on. So the reason why Pachman rules are actually interesting is that, first of all, they are elementary, so they involve only a fixed number of simplices per step, so they are really local moves. Then, furthermore, they are actually ergodic and topology preserving, so meaning that we can actually map between any two triangulations of a fixed topology by finite sequences of these moves. So we only consider here finite triangulations. So in that sense, they're really a very general elementary class of moves. And these are therefore the discrete evolution moves that we employ here for generating our discrete time evolution. So so these Pachman moves, they're topology preserving. That means in this case, since they act in the hypersurfaces, the topology of the spatial hypersurfaces will be preserved. That means at the end of the day, the topology of the full triangulation is just given of a product type I times sigma, where I is some interval, and so on. That is also very much like in canonical general relativity. Okay, so let's move on to slide number 10, please. So here is another discrete movie of how you can envisage the evolution of a two-dimensional hypersurface in terms of Pachman moves. Could those of you sitting at the next button please press it another 8 times in a row? And my apologies for these rudimentary movie skills. This is the last time you have to do it that many times in a row. Okay, so and now let's go to slide number 11. And here we now see, the task is that we want to implement these Pachman moves into a canonical language. So these are the elementary evolution moves that we want to employ to get our discrete time evolution. And so if we want to put that into a canonical language, we face a priori two problems. So and the first problem is that what you can already see here from this 1-3 Pachman move is that in general, the hypersurfaces at different time steps will actually overlap. And so and that means actually that subsets of edges will overlap at different steps k and k plus 1. And now recall that in the Radic calculus, the length of the edges are the configuration variables. So that means that at different time steps, the subsets of variables will coincide. Okay, and then there's also the problem B, which you can also see here from the 1-3 Pachman move, is that after the move, we have three edges more than before. That means we have actually more variables after the move. And so it means, in general, actually, we have a varying phase space dimension from step to step. And so this brings us back to the problem of foliations that I mentioned in the beginning. So these are the problems that we have to solve now. We want to translate that into canonical language. And that is what we want to do now. So let's please go to slide number 12. So actually, in the following slide, I will not talk about superficial gravity in particular, but rather about general discrete systems. So I will outline here a canonical formalism, which is very general. And we will then later on apply this to superficial gravity and to Radic calculus in particular. So, so for the moment, we will only look at general discrete systems. So the central idea that we have now in order to generate time evolution is to employ Hamilton's principal function, which is just the action evaluated on solutions as a function of initial and final data. And to use this principal function as a generating function of first kind to generate time evolution, and generating function of first kind means it depends on old and on new configuration variables, and then we can obtain momenta corresponding to these configuration variables by just deriving that generating function with respect to the configuration variables. So that is the basic idea. Now let's look at some discrete action, some discrete system described by the discrete action, which is a sum of contributions from different discrete time steps. We label these discrete time steps by small n. And so on each of these contributions is now a function on the direct product of configuration manifolds, Qn minus 1 times Qn, into the reals. And so on, this is a different in the discrete as compared to the continuum, because in the continuum we have the Lagrangian being a function on the tangent bundle, where the tangent bundle is coordinatized in discrete mechanics by mechanics by Q and Q dot. So in here, in this case, in the discrete, the tangent bundle is taken, the role of the tangent bundle is taken over by the product of configuration manifolds, and the role of Q and Q dot is taken over here by xn minus 1 and xn. And so I just note that I'm actually suppressing additional indices on the axis. So the xn minus 1 and xn each can actually represent a whole set of data, of degrees of freedom. But for simplicity, we just suppress those indices. Okay, so now what we're actually going to do here is variational discrete mechanics, variational in the sense that these configuration manifolds, Qn, are continuous. So it's discrete in the sense that we have discrete numbers of degrees of freedom and a discrete time evolution. And this is also what happens in the Radje calculus, because in the Radje calculus, the length are the configuration variables. And these, of course, can take a continuous values in continuous intervals. So, so this is the idea. And later on, we will apply this to Radje calculus. Okay, so then we use Sn now, the contribution from a given step as a generating function. So we have to derive that generating function with respect to the old and new configuration variables, so that we get actually two different types of momenta at step n minus 1 and n, and we shall call these momenta pre-momenta and post-momenta. Okay, so let's go to slide number 13. So and on the top of slide number 13 in equation 1, you again see the pre-momenta and post-momenta in blue and red that from the previous slide. And so one thing to note is that these pre- and post-momenta in equation 1 define an implicit time evolution map, which is given in equation 2. And the reason how one can see that they do that is, so time evolution map, sorry, from the canonical data at step n minus 1 to the data at step n. And how one can see that it happens is by looking, for example, at the pre-momenta in equation 1 given by the blue equation. In principle, we should be able to solve it for xn as a function of the data at step n minus 1. It may not be unique, but in general, we should be able to solve it. And once we have that xn, then we could insert it in the equation for the post-momentum given in red in equation 1, such that we then have the data at step n. Okay, so far we have only been using the action contribution from step n minus 1 to n, which you can see on the right-hand side in this little sketch. We have only used that as a generating function, but of course you could equally well use the action contribution between step n and n plus 1 as a generating function, and that is what we do in equation 3. In that way, we can actually then also define the pre-momenta, given in blue now, at step one, so that at step n, now we have two types of momenta, namely pre and post momenta. The pre momenta given in blue in equation 3, and the post momenta given in red in equation 1. So, but then what actually happens is that if we now implement the equations of motion of the data at step n, that is given underneath equation 3, and we compare that equation of motion with the pre-momenta in blue in equation 3 and the post-momenta in red in equation 1, then we see that the equations of motions implement or are equivalent to a momentum matching. That means that the pre- and post-momenta at a given step are identical, have to be the same on solutions. Okay, let's move on to slide number 14. I will tell you something about discrete Legendre transformations now. They will be relevant in a minute. Let's start by recalling that in the continuum, the Legendre transformations map us from the tangent bundle to the cotangent bundle. In coordinates, they map Q and Q dots to Q and P, where P is just given as the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocity. And now we have something similar, actually, also in the discrete. But there's a difference, because now, actually, we have this action contribution as n depends on two configuration variables. And it's a function on a direct product of configuration manifolds, Qn minus 1 cross Qn, which takes over the role from the tangent bundle. And in that sense, actually, here we can define two Legendre transformations, which we call a pre- and a post-Legendre transformation. And they are given in red and blue, respectively, in the bottom part of that slide. So and what they do is really they just map us to the pre- and post-momenta as we have given them in the previous slide. So they map to the whole tangent bundles at step n minus one. So this is the difference between the discrete and the continuum that we now have actually two Bajano transformations. Okay, let's move on to slide number 15. So nevertheless, we can show actually that just as in the continuum, what we get is that the symplectic form on the cotangent bundles is related to the Lagrangian 2 form, which in this case in the discrete lives on the direct product of configuration manifolds, so which takes over the role from the tangent bundle, so that these Lagrangian 2 forms and the symplectic form are just related to each other by a pullback of the pre and the post Legendre transformations. So that is qualitatively just like in the continuum, just that we map here between phase spaces of different time steps. Okay, so on the Lagrangian 2 form, in fact, is given in coordinates as indicated there in the last line. So basically, the given by the matrix of second derivatives of the action with respect to the with respect to the variables at the two time steps. The reason I mentioned that is relevant for the next slide because it's relevant for discussing constraints. So first of all, let's recall that in the continuum, the Legendre transformation fails to be an isomorphism when the matrix of second derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities is degenerate. So in that case, then we only map to a constraint surface in the phase space, and then, of course, we get some constraints. And so this is very similar here now, in, also in the discrete, with the sole difference, again, that we now have two Legendre transformations, the pre and the post Legendre transformation. And in fact, they both fail to be isomorphisms simultaneously, if and only if the Lagrangian 2 form that I gave you on the previous slide is degenerate. So that's very much like in the continuum, just that now we get two constraint surfaces. And so we actually call so the image of the post Legendre transformation into the phase space at step n, that's what we call the post-constraint surface, and the image of the pre-Legendre transformation into the phase space at step n minus 1, that's what we call the pre-constraint surface. So we get two constraint surfaces here, and in fact they are basically governed by the degenerate directions of the two form, and since it has as many left as right null vectors, that means then, in fact, that the dimensions of the post and pre-constraint surface here have to be the same. So, and in the end, I hope I can discuss that towards the end of the talk. The non-trivial feature at the end will then be actually to get a matching of post and pre-constraint surfaces at given time steps. And so that is something that will be rather non-trivial. And so, and please note that also the post and pre-constraint surfaces, I'm discussing them quite generally here, but they will also arise very prominently in the Puffner moves in the Legendre calculus later on. So let's move on to slide number 17. So now that we have these constraint surfaces, it turns out that the time evolution map that I gave you before, which actually reads as an equation 4, given by the pre and post momenta, is now only defined between or on and between the constraint surfaces. And that's, of course, so because the pre and post momenta are not all independent, because now we have, of course, the pre and post constraints. So now, in general, when we have time evolution, canonically, that's usually implemented as a symplectic transformation. But note that in this case, this is not possible because the time evolution is only defined on the constraint surfaces. But it turns out that one can show that the symplectic form restricted to these constraint surfaces is actually preserved under this time evolution map. So in that sense, it is a canonical mapping. Okay, so now if we look at the equation 4 again, in particular at the pre-momentum in on the left-hand side, one thing that happens in the presence of constraints, if you use the implicit function theorem, it will tell us that, of course, we cannot solve that equation for xn uniquely as a function of the data at step n minus 1, and rather we have to choose some free parameters, which we denote here by lambda. So these are a priori free parameters. That is, of course, just like in the continuum. So, and it means that a priori we get some arbitrariness in the evolution. And, well, of course, some of these free parameters can get fixed by secondary constraints. But okay, so these free parameters, they will also feature very prominently in the Pachner moves in the Raja calculus, and we will see them later on again.
Yeah, I have a question here. So for this theorem, when you say that the symplectic form restricted to the constrained surface is preserved under the dynamics, I just want to make sure what you mean by restricted, because there are two senses. One is really restricted just means that I look at the full symplectic structure, but look at only those points which lie on the constrained surface. That is to say, I mean, in the continuum, it would correspond to the symplectic structure is not pulled back. The second stronger version would be that I just pull back the symplectic structure. That is to say, I allow myself only to plug in tangent vectors which are tangential to the constrained surface. But a weaker version would be to say that I just look at the constrained surface and I just look at the full symplectic structure at the points of the constrained surface. So which of these two do you mean is preserved?
So what we're doing here is basically we use an embedding of the constrained surface, and then we pull back the full symplectic structure under the embedding to the constrained surface, and then we take the that's how we mean it. Sorry, is that clear? Or
so it's only the pullback that is preserved.
Yeah, I mean, so the pullback. So we have an embedding of the constrained surfaces, the pre and post constrained surface, and then then we basically pull back the full syntactic structure to that under the pullback to the constrained surface, and then this pullback basically is then preserved under this time evolution map.
Okay, and you don't know, or it is not true or not meaningful, that one could also ask, is the full symplectic structure preserved? And you're saying that either it's not meaningful in the discrete setting, or I mean, I just look at a submanifold, but I can still look at a sensor which is in a bigger space.
Mm-hmm.
And I can ask, I got some flow, and under that flow, is it true that this bigger tensor is actually preserved? So do you know the answer, or you think it is a meaningless question in the discrete context?
So you mean whether the time evolution can be extended off the constraint surface, you mean?
Such that the full symplectic structure is actually...
In principle, that is also possible here and also later for the Pachner moves. I mean, one can... in this case here, really, it probably is not really meaningful because the time evolution map as we have it here in equation 4 is really only defined on the constraint surfaces because the momenta are just not independent. But in fact, later on for the Pachner moves, we will see that... there, it is actually both possible. I'm not sure if I will discuss this here, but that is actually possible that you can extend the time evolution that is generated by the Pachner moves off the constraint surface and into the full phase space. The symplectic transformation, but the only thing is that at the end one has to impose the constraints by hand so that one ends up on the constraint surface again. But I don't know, does that answer your question? Or?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. So now we have discussed these discrete structures in general. So now let's move on and do this in Raja calculus in particular. So let's go on to slide number 18. And so let's just apply what we did before to Raja calculus. And so the goal is now to define the canonical momenta in the hypersurfaces. The momenta of all edges on the hypersurface. And in order to do that, what we need to do is actually we need to group up the symplices that we counted by k into fat slices that we count now by n. So what we do now is, we define the momenta of all edges on the hypersurface at this stage, and then subsequently we will look at how these momenta transform under the Pachner move. So that will be the subsequent topic. Okay, so the basic idea here is now, we group them up into these fat slices. At this stage, it doesn't really matter how the hypersurfaces there are chosen. For the moment, let's just assume they're non-intersecting. One can also deal with it when they intersect, but this, let's for simplicity assume that is not the case. So the idea is now that we choose all the edges that lie between sigma n and sigma n minus 1, as you see on that little sketch. We assign all these internal edges to step n and denote the edges by Lin. And also we denote the edges in sigma n by len, as you see that there in the expression for the action contribution of step n. Okay, and then we have an action which is a function of old and new configuration variables. And now we want to use that action contribution of fat slice n, again, as a generating function for the evolution by fat slices. So as we had it before, basically, so it's again a generating function of first kind. And so we obtain then the pre and the post momenta, just as before, by deriving this generating function with respect to the configuration variables. And this is given in equation 5 and 6. And well, in 6, the last equation is actually constrained, and so P has to vanish, and that has to do with the fact that the action contribution as n does not depend on the internal length of edges at step n minus 1. Okay, so what I should say maybe at this stage is that the momenta thus defined are actually related to the extrinsic curvature angles around the boundary hinges. And so in that sense, they really encode the extrinsic curvature of that hypersurface. And as I said in the beginning, the length of the edges in the triangulation completely determine the intrinsic geometry of that triangulation. So and in particular here, the length of the edges in the triangulation describe basically, therefore, the metric on that hypersurface. So in that sense, the canonical pairs that we have here in the Legendre calculus are qualitatively very similar to those in canonical general relativity. Okay, let's move on, please, to slide number 19. So here you see in 7 and 8, again, the pre and post momenta from the previous slide. So, and just as we discussed it in for the general discrete systems before, of course, here we could also choose to use the action contribution of fat slice n plus 1 as a generating function, in which case we can then also define the pre momenta at step n. They are given again in blue there below equation 8. So now again, we have the pre-momenta and the post-momenta at step n. And again, if we impose the equations of motions for those variables in sigma n, so the length LEN, then again, these equations of motions are equivalent to a momentum matching here. So it means that the pre- and post-momenta have to be the same on solutions. Okay, and this also holds in particular for internal variables. So we're, in this case, the equations of motions of internal degrees of freedom directly translate into constraints in the canonical setting. The momenta have to vanish, so pi equals zero. So in that sense, really, equations of motions appear as constraints. And this is important because that means once we have a given hypersurface, all edges that occur to the past or future of that hypersurface actually come with constraints, which are the equations of motion. That will be relevant in a minute. Okay, let's move on to slide number 20. So I've told you now how one can define the momenta in the Legendre calculus on a given hypersurface. Now let's have a look at how they transform under Pachner moves. So let's return to the Pachner moves, which we count by k, and I'll assume that this hypersurface sigma n that we had previously coincides with some hypersurface sigma k that is obtained after some sequence of Pachner moves. And furthermore, let us define what we can call a past action, Sk plus, which is just the sum of all action contributions of all simplicities to the past of sigma k, as you see that in the sketch on the right. And so it turns out that if we do this, in fact, the previous momenta on the slide just before translate at every step k into equation 9. So we just derive the past action with respect to IEK. And so that has to hold at every step k, and that means also it has to hold at step k plus 1. So, and when we perform a Pachner move, then note that the action is additive. It means that actually in this case, the Pachner moves require what we can call a momentum updating, and that is what is given in equation 10. So in equation 10, therefore guarantees that equation 9 holds at every step k. So equation 10 is what the Pachner moves actually do to the momenta. Okay, there's a nice geometric interpretation of this in 3D, so let's go to slide number 21. So in three dimensions, on solutions, the Legendre action, in fact, is only a boundary term because bulk definite angles all have to vanish, and in which case it turns out that the momenta of the edges in the boundary coincides with the extrinsic curvature angles around these edges. And that basically just tells us that momentum updating, in this case, is just an angle updating. So if you see that little sketch on the bottom, please press next now. For example, if we perform here a 1-3 Pachner move, then of course the extrinsic angle around E has changed. And momentum updating is just telling us that we should also update in this angle here. So in four dimensions, the interpretation is it's a little more convoluted. But let's go now to slide number 22. So, and let's recall the problems that we had, or the challenges that we had for implementing these Fachner moves into canonical language. So the first problem A was that we have subsets of variables coinciding at different steps. And problem B was that actually the phase-based dimension will vary generically. And so let me tell you now how one can solve these issues. So let's go to slide number 23. And we solve problem A, so the problem of coinciding subsets of variables, simply by momentum updating. So it means for all edges occurring in both sigma k and sigma k plus 1, so the hypersurfaces before and after the move, we just map the length of the edges to themselves. So clearly, the length should be the same. And then we update the momenta according to what I just told you before. So, and then we solve problem B, the problem of having a varying phase-based dimension by a form of phase-based extension. Recall that once we have a given hypersurface, that all edges to the future or past of it actually come with a vanishing momentum. So they actually come with a constraint, which is just the equation of motion. And so that means in particular that we can, at this stage, formally add all the variables, canonical variables associated to edges to the past or future of a given hypersurface to the phase space at that time, just noting that these canonical pairs are all constrained by this momentum t equals zero. So in that sense, at that stage, it is rather trivial, a phase space extension, but it allows us to put the phase spaces at the different steps to equal dimension. And on these phase spaces, we can then actually perform a momentum updating as for all the variables as explained before. So in fact, one could extend the phase space already at k equals zero and carry around all the data, but this is just carrying around too much information for most of the evolution. So that's why we choose only to extend phase spaces whenever the data become relevant. And it turns out to be equivalent action. So I will illustrate that in a minute with an example. But it turns out that if we do this here, in this way, then the Fachner moves can be implemented as canonical transformations, where I put canonical transformation here in quotation marks, because, there exist two ways of doing it. One, as I said before, and to Abai's question, it is possible to implement them as canonical transformations on the full phase space, but one has to impose the constraints by hand afterwards. But the more elegant version is to, that's also what we will do here, is where the transformations are defined only on and between the constraint surfaces, and they preserve the symplectic structure, as I said it before, and they're canonical in that sense. Okay, let's move on to slide number 24. So here we have the 1-3 Fachner move. Assume we have carried out the 1-3 Fachner move. So we have three new edges after the move. And now we want to solve the problem B of varying phase space dimensions. So what we do basically is we extend the phase space at step K, so before the move, by the three new pairs corresponding to the new edges. And now we want to implement a transformation that is such that before the move, the momenta are in zero of these new edges, and after the move, they should be in agreement with the general definition of the momenta that I explained before. So, and in fact, it turns out that we can use the action contribution of the new tetrahedron tau as a type 1 generating function again, so depending on all the new configuration variables, and in this case with a trivial dependence on L and K, so it doesn't depend on it. And if we do that and differentiate that generating function, then we get the equations in 11, and that is exactly what we want. So the momenta vanish before the move, and after the move, basically are in agreement with momentum updating. So, okay, so here we have a generating function for only the new variables, but we also want a generating function that involves all variables in the hypersurface, which implements the transformation according to the evolution by the Fachner moves. So before I gave you the generating function for evolution by fat slices, now we want to do the generating functions for the evolution by Fachner moves. And so let's go to slide number 25. This looks a little more complicated than it is, but let me walk you through it. So now we go to four dimensions. So we consider here in particular the so-called 1-4 Fachner move. All this move does is really it introduces four new edges labeled by N and a new vertex. And so that means that we have to extend the phase space by four pairs before the move. And what we get is a generating function that is given in equation 12. This is a generating function that is of mixed type, so it's a first kind in the variables LNK and LNK plus 1 and images of second kind in all the other variables. And so what we have to do now in order to get the evolution equations or the transformation equations corresponding to that generating function, we just have to differentiate it with respect to the canonical data. And that is what is given in equations 13, 14, and 15, and I will just walk you through it now. So in equation 13, you see the evolution equation for all those edges, which we label by B, which in fact are passive edges, so they occur in the hypersurface but are not involved in the move. So there, the data are just, well, these are just identical transformation, identity transformations, and that is, of course, what should happen. Then in 14, you see the transformation equations for those edges that are involved in the move, but that occur in both hypersurfaces before and after the move. Here, the edges are mapped to themselves, and the momenta are just updated according to momentum updating, so this is also as it should be. And then in 15, we get the momenta of the new edges before and after the move, and it implements that the momenta again have to vanish before the move as it should be, and after the move, we get this expression in equation 15, which is given in red. And the reason I'm putting that in red is because that expression on the right-hand side of equation 15 only depends on the data, on the configuration data at step k plus 1. And it is therefore, equation 15 is therefore a constraint. It's on the data at k plus 1 and is therefore a post constraint. So here we actually have an example of a post constraint that we discussed a little more generally before. So, but note now that these equations do not determine at all the length of the four new edges. And the reason is basically that we don't have any equations of motions in this move. There's no edges becoming internal in this move. So there's no way of determining the length of the new edges. And so that means actually in this case, the free parameters that I mentioned generally before, the lambdas, they actually coincide with the new length of the new edges here in this case. So, and of course, we can choose a gauge choice. We can map, basically, we can set the length of the new edges at step k and k plus 1 equal to each other, and then we choose to keep L and k as an additional initial data into our phase space. So basically, what happens here in the discrete now is that the complete initial data is only distributed in the course of discrete evolution. Okay. Let's move on to slide number 26. So here we'll only summarize the Pachner moves in four dimensions of superficial gravity. So the Pachner moves acting on the three-dimensional hypersurfaces. So we have just seen the 1-4 Pachner move. It comes with four post constraints. Please press next now. You should be seeing a 2-3 move now. This move introduces one edge. One new edge, but no new internal edge is generated, so there's no equation of motion involved in this move. And that means, again, that the length of the new edge can be freely chosen, and this is particularly relevant here because this move also renders one triangle internal. And now recall from the very beginning that internal triangles carry the curvature in four-dimensional ledger calculus, so in particular, they carry the deficit angles, and this new deficit angle will actually depend on the length of the new edge, and that means actually that in this move we can generate a curvature which a priori can be freely chosen. And so again, the new edge here comes with a post constraint. So these post constraints, in fact, are all automatically satisfied after the move has been carried out. So on the underlying triangulation, they do not really impose any non-trivial conditions at that stage. And now it turns out that the 1-4 and the 2-3 moves are the only moves in four dimensions which generate new edges in the triangulation, and we see there's no equations of motion involved at this stage, so that means that in general we can freely choose all new edges that we introduce into the triangulation. But that holds only a priori, because of course this is not the end of the story. Please press next, because there's also, for example, a 4-1 move. This one inverts the 1-4 move. This one, in fact, removes four old edges from the triangulation. They become internal. And being the inverse of the 1-4 move, it doesn't come with post constraints, but it now comes with four free constraints. So, and these free constraints are conditions now at step k, so before the move. And it turns out that these free constraints are non-trivial at step k, so they are not automatically satisfied. And in fact, they are equivalent to the equations of motion for the four new edges that become internal. So, and if these constraints, the three constraints cannot be satisfied, then the move cannot be carried out. Okay, please press next. There's also the 3-2 move, which inverts the 2-3 move. And this one removes one old edge, and it also comes with a three constraint. Okay, so these four Pachner moves are all the Pachner moves for the evolution and four dimensions. And let us discuss a little more on the constraints now. Please go to slide number 27. So one thing to note here is now that the key difference between three dimensions and four dimensions is that in three dimensions, all the constraints are preserved under the Pachner moves, and no symmetries are broken, everything is fine under control, and this is not the case in four dimensions. So constraints are here not necessarily preserved. And, okay, let us talk a little more about the four-dimensional case now. Note that a priori, the post constraints of the 1-4 and the 2-3 move, in fact, form an abelian Poisson algebra. But nevertheless, a priori, they do not generate gauge transformations of the action. And the gauge transformations of the action in Regge calculus correspond to vertex displacements in the bulk, which leave the geometry invariant. So as you can see that in a little figure there, if you move around a vertex in a flat neighborhood and you adjust the length accordingly, then you don't change the geometry. It also holds actually in the linearized case. And this, in fact, these are, in fact, the gauge symmetries of a Regge calculus. But it turns out that a priori, these post constraints do not generate that. So rather, they reflect the lack of information at this stage about the lack of information in a given hypersurface about the full four-dimensional solution. So given initial data, we face non-uniqueness of solutions. So, and okay, let's go to slide number 28. What is important now is, of course, that a posteriori, the first or second class nature, really depends on the pre-constraints of the 3-2 and 4-1 moves. So the pre-constraints are also constraints that exist in the phase space at step k. So we have the post-constraint surface, which you see in that sketch on the upper left part of that slide, which again is the image of the post Legendre transformation, basically corresponding to the past action or the past triangulation at step k, which you see in the right-hand side of that figure. And well, that's the image in the phase space at step k. And please press next. There's also the pre-constraint surface, which is the image of the pre-Legendre transformation into that phase space, so the pre-Legendre transformation corresponding to the future piece of triangulation at step k. And please press next. And of course, if these two constraint surfaces do not coincide, then the pre-constraints are in fact independent conditions, so independent from the post-constraints, and that means they can fix some of the flows of the post-constraints. And in particular, that means a posteriori, they can fix some of the three lengths that arise in the 1-4 and the 2-3 move. So after all, we may not have such a big freedom in evolution after all. And it turns out, in fact, that these three constraints can fix three parameters that have been introduced many, many steps before in such a way that actually determining whether we have three lengths at the end, three parameters at the end of the day, is really becomes a very non-local problem, non-local in discrete time here. So, but if at the end of the day we are left with some free length or free parameters that are not fixed, then that means we obtain some proper gauge transformations. But note that in general it turns out that gauge symmetry in the Regge calculus is generically broken in the presence of curvature. Okay, let me maybe try to illustrate this matching or unmatching of pre and post constraints in a simple example. Let's go to slide number 29.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
So you're saying it can be the case if I have some initial time and choose some initial data, it can be the case that 400 million steps later you discover that that initial data was inconsistent?
Well, not necessarily inconsistent, just that some of these data that you introduce freely, they may get fixed later on by later steps. So it doesn't need to be inconsistent, just that, they just get fixed. So and the reason for this is basically that...
But if they get fixed by later steps, then a choice that I could have made at a much earlier step can turn out to be an inconsistent choice.
Yeah. That's true. So, I mean, the reason for this is essentially... Sorry?
Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I mean, the reason for this is essentially that what happens here in the when you have varying phase space dimension, it's a peculiar feature that the numbers of constraints that you have at a given hypersurface turns out to depend on the initial and final slice between which you actually evolve. And so and that's basically the reason why it can happen that certain things get fixed later on. So in a sense, actually, what fixes the number of constraints is what one could call a minimal slice, or maximal in a sense, which has the maximum number of constraints. In fact, there are isomorphisms that would then carry around these constraints to other steps. But I unfortunately probably won't really have time to discuss this here. Maybe let me go on to slide number 29 now. So let's consider this in a simple example. So let's consider the boundary surface of a single force simplex. So you see the 3D analog of that situation in that picture there on the right. So what we want to do is now we want to perform four Pachner moves in order to render that vertex V naught internal. In 3D, we would have to perform three Pachner moves. Here in four dimensions, we have to perform four Pachner moves. And so what we do is we perform
Philip, we are losing. Yeah. See somebody has a mic open. If so, please close that, except for Philip.
Sorry, I can't see anything. It's a lot of noise. Do you hear me? So I'm wondering what you...
Position of your... Can you change the position of your speaker? Your mic?
I'm awfully soft. I can't really hear anything. Okay, now can you...
Hi, this is LSU. We cannot hear anyone right now. When you talk, if it is, you're talking a lot of disturbance, and I assume that when I am talking, you are also getting a lot of disturbance.
Hello?
Hello, this is the speaker again. I will try to reconnect to the end of some of my own stuff. Can you hear me?
Hello, we can hear you.
that is your force. So we do is now perform half on the force before upper work free net. For free parameters, after that we perform free move. This one introduces one a priori free parameter again, which is the free length, and then the curvature is also it can be freely chosen because it actually depends on that new length. And so that means at that step, after the 2-3 move, we actually have five free parameters. So now we want to go on and perform another 3-2 move that annihilates one edge and comes with a pre-constraint. And then we perform another 4-1 move, which annihilates four edges and the vertex V0, and it comes with four pre-constraints again. So now what we want to see is, okay, we have now five free parameters and five pre-constraints, and we want to see what those five parameters. So now it turns out that after the 3-2 move, the triangulation actually corresponds to a configuration of a stacked sphere, and a stacked sphere, in fact, is a configuration that is obtained as basically starting from a single force simplex and only performing one 4-Pachner move on it, so we never generate any internal degrees of freedom, no curvature at all, so it has to be flat. And that means also that the triangulation, in fact, after the 3-2 move has to be flat. So it means that, in fact, the pre-constraint of the 3-2 move in this case imposes flatness, and that is a non-trivial condition in that case because the previous move, the 2-3 move, has introduced a free curvature. So and that means, in this case, this free constraint puts a condition on the five free parameters, and so it means only four free parameters remain at that step. And then, okay, we can perform the 4-1 move, and it turns out that after the 4-1 move, the configuration still corresponds to that of a stacked sphere, so it still has to be flat, but it was already flat before that move, and no new variables have been introduced in that move, and that means, in fact, that the four free constraints of that 4-1 move are automatically satisfied. So that means, well, or in other words, these four pre-constraints match four post-constraints of these annihilated edges. And so at the end of the day, we have then four free parameters surviving, and that means we actually have a fourfold gauge freedom at the vertex V naught. So and this is exactly what we would expect because, you know, I have a flat piece of triangulation, and we know that vertices living in a flat piece can be moved around corresponding to the vertex displacement gauge symmetry of the Lagerka calculus. And of course, this can be done to more complicated situations, and we don't have time to discuss that here, so let's go to the conclusions. Let's go to slide number 30. So what have we done here? We have devised a general canonical framework for discrete systems, so not only superficial gravity, and which can cope with varying phase space dimensions. It turns out to be equivalent to the covariant formalism, so we make sure at every step to solve all the equations of motion. And in particular, we can apply this framework to simplicial gravity, thereby implementing a very general and elementary discrete time evolution scheme, which is not generated by any constraints. And in fact, while the most elementary steps are interpreted as Pachner moves, but one can also consider more complicated evolution steps, which can be decomposed into Pachner moves. Okay, and then now if we want to really know what sort of degrees of freedom evolve under these Pachner dynamics, then what we need is a complete constraint classification of the pre and post constraints to identify evolving degrees of freedom. As I already mentioned before, this is a rather non-trivial issue here in the discrete when you're varying phase-space dimensions, because the numbers of constraints on a hypersurface depend also on from where to where you actually evolve. So I didn't really have time to discuss it more, but this is work that will, well, that is to appear. Hopefully it will appear soon in the near future. And then, of course, one can also apply this framework to the 4D linearized theory and study the graviton dynamics in the discrete. I also didn't really have time to go into this. This is also work to appear, so hopefully in the near future. Please go to slide number 31. So that's an outlook on this presentation. So since we use the abstract function here, I wish I also had a dynamic framework of the function theory is basic idea, basically given the wave function of that case. We can explain the wave function that says if one has the next to the new function theory says, take part there. Basically, we can do is the wave function, the object function, and multiply the exponential of the actual distribution of function. That is in the public space. And then we have to integrate the idea of by putting other that you have in the we do that for many steps, then we have to get a CS is basically the distributor for
if it does not go away. Hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you, yeah.
Okay. Because last 5 minutes, again, we lost you completely. So if people are still on, some people signed off because there is a problem, we can have some questions.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't hear anything anymore. I was trying to reconnect, but apparently didn't really work.
I can ask a question.
Yeah.
So, in order, the way that you take care of the changing the number of variables in the phase space is basically as if you start with an initial surface and then you have to specify exactly what is the sequence of Pachter moves going to be, because to know what the whole extended phase space is, you have to know not just the next move, but the whole sequence of moves coming in the future.
One could do that, but this is not actually necessary here, because all the variables of much later Pachter moves in the beginning are completely irrelevant, because they're just basically constrained canonical pairs. They will only become relevant at the stage when the Pachter move is actually carried out. And so that's why we don't choose to actually consider already at the first step a complete phase space extension, which takes into account all variables associated to all edges, but we only extend the phase space accordingly when they become relevant. It doesn't really matter for that evolution when you extend it, the phase space, because these are basically, before the Pachter move is carried out, which introduces these new variables. These new variables at much earlier steps are just passive variables that are carried along without doing anything, so there's no point in doing that. And so that's why it is consistent to just extend the phase spaces whenever these variables become relevant. But of course, when one wants to look at it more from the picture of the covariant phase space, then one has to worry about these things. And well, that's also one thing that we're working on. So in which case one has to specify then a little more carefully the space of solutions, which in the discrete is a little more complicated here because we have to take into account also trivial subdivisions of simplices and so on. And then, in which case then triangulations which are related by trivial subdivisions should be identified, of course, geometrically. And if one wants to take that into account in a full covariant phase space, then that becomes a little more complicated. But I didn't really discuss that here.
Okay, but I was asking I understand that. I was asking a simpler question. If you regard this as a kind of approximation scheme, I can appreciate that. If you regard this as a proposal for how the laws of physics are to be formulated, then you have an interesting kind of freedom in the laws of physics. That is, because there's a free choice, given that you're on you've evolved to some surface, there's a free choice of which Pachner moves are made next, and then there's a set of constraints and equations of motion which follow those free choices. But do you regard those free choices as somehow part of a freedom allowed in the laws of nature?
Well, actually, one thing that I should probably say here is, one thing that is, a priori we have this free choice, that is true, but generally we will not have so much free choice because of all these free constraints which can fix free parameters arising earlier. And probably what is really relevant here is now a complete constraint classification scheme which allows us to identify what precisely are the physical and non-physical degrees of freedom, because the relevant question, I think, is then what is actually the reduced phase space here. So the question is then really, is in this scheme here, the dimension of the reduced phase space, does it actually also vary over the time evolution, or does it remain constant? Because if it remains constant, then presumably we won't even actually have that much free choice. So, and this is one thing that still, unfortunately, is not completely resolved in our work. That's one thing we are currently working on. One thing that one can already say at this stage is, for example, if you start out with a completely constrained phase space, so let's assume we start from a single force simplex, and so we have a phase space corresponding to 10 edges, so we have 10 lengths and some momenta. It turns out that this phase space is completely constrained. And it turns out that the number of constraints in the evolution in general can never decrease. It can only stay constant or increase. And what happens then in this case is that once you start out from a completely constrained phase space, you will never get anything but a completely constrained phase space. So in that sense, you start out from a zero-dimensional reduced phase space, and it will remain zero-dimensional throughout evolution. So this is, in this particular case, how this behaves when you actually start out from something where the phase space originally is not completely constrained, how that behaves in general, whether the reduced phase space will then also be preserved, the dimension of it, or whether it may vary, that is something that still actually has to be completely clarified.
Okay, thank you.
But I'm not quite sure that what sense you have a canonical framework, really. I mean, it's really continuing Lee's question. Normally when I have a canonical framework, I give you, right, that initially I specify what the phase space is. So do you specify the phase space by the initial choices that you are given? Because it also increases, right? And if I start out with some phase space, how do I know that subsequent evolution will not come back and tell me that I should have chosen some other data? That is to say, the data that I have does not lead to a consistent solution.
What precisely was the question? How do I know that the initial data does lead to consistent evolution? Sorry, I didn't quite...
I don't know. I mean, when you say you have a canonical framework, right? I mean, I supposed to say, tell you, I got this phase space, I got these constraints, I got this evolution equation.
Yes.
The evolution equations preserve these constraints, and therefore I got this space of solutions. I don't see these steps in what you are saying, because, as you just explained to Lee, it may happen that you start with some initial data, and then at a much later time, you might find that what you had done, that your initial data was not allowed, and you really had to go and change it in order to get a consistent solution. So I do not know what is a phase space. Go back to your transparency 27, if you just go back there.
Yeah.
You say that 4D constraints are not necessarily preserved.
Yes.
Well, that is not a consistent Hamiltonian framework, right?
Constraints in the sense that, the numbers of constraints in total, yes, but I mean, what I mean here is, for example, that... So, for example, in three dimensions, we have three constraints per vertex and corresponding also to the gauge symmetry, and these are preserved as the evolution. So at every step, at every vertex, we have three constraints. And so here it turns out that in four dimensions, this is not necessarily the case. For example, in the 1-4 Pachner move, we introduce four new constraints, and they... corresponding to the four new edges, but there's no guarantee that when we evolve further and have some, for example, some 3-2 moves or 4-1 moves acting on it later on, which come with pre-constraints, that there will still be four constraints later on living at that vertex, so which correspond to that gauge freedom. So, but, the number of constraints, since the time evolution actually preserves the constraint surface, the total number of constraints actually is preserved. So,
okay, so if I have a consistent constraint Hamiltonian framework, then it should be a consequence that the reduced phase space dimension is a constant. But you're just telling us, in reply to Lee's question, that this is an open question. So there's something...
Yeah, it is an open question, but it may very well be the case that it is a constant, in which case then we don't have so much arbitrariness in the evolution after all. So, but that is one thing that one has to look really a little more carefully at the space of solutions in the end, basically in the spirit of a covariant phase space picture. But that is one thing, again,
is more close to the covariant phase space, right? I mean, because somehow everything depends on the evolution. It depends on, I mean, if I've given you some redundant data, then as you said, I may have to go back and change that data, right? I mean, I may think that I got a freedom in choosing some data, but later evolution will tell me that I should go back and change that data. That's what you said. Am I right about this?
Yeah.
Right. So therefore, I mean, in some sense, I don't have a phase space, right? Because if I had a phase space, then I know what the data is. I don't have to change it. I mean, all possible data are allowed. But on the other hand, at the moment, you're saying that, well, no. I mean, it may happen that some data that I thought was allowed is not allowed. So if that is the case, then I feel that I don't know what the phase space is. And then, phase space point of view.
Can I express, there's a complimentary worry to that. Can you demonstrate, is there a danger that if you pick some initial data and you start to evolve according to your rules, you pick the Pachner moves by some algorithm, that at some moment it will just freeze? That is, there will be no solution to the pre or post constraints?
That's actually a very interesting question. I mean, in principle, you can always carry out 1-4 Pachner moves and 2-3 Pachner moves. I mean, there's no restriction on those because, I mean, they don't really... there's no non-trivial conditions on these because they only introduce new variables which can be freely chosen. So, and then the question is whether when you perform a whole sequence of those 1-4 and 2-3 Pachner moves, whether at some later step you can then find possibilities to, again, move further with 4-1 and the 3-2 moves. I mean, the question whether you can do that generally, that you do a sequence of all Pachner moves, I don't know. I kind of really answer that at this stage. But what you surely can always do is really evolve always with 1-4 or 2-3 moves. So, I mean, that wouldn't stop. I mean.
Okay.
But, I mean, they don't, at that stage, when you only perform 1-4 or 2-3 partner moves, because basically all they do at that stage is they kind of, at that step, only add some new boundary data and nothing new about the internal data. When you only perform those moves, then you don't at that stage don't really get any interesting new internal physics basically. You know, there's no new internal degrees of freedom for that. You really need the 3-2 and 4-1 moves.
When you say that you have got compatibility with covariant phase space or covariant framework. So you're saying that no matter what order you choose these moves, you'll get some solution. You'll get a solution to the Rajé equations in 4 dimensions?
Sorry, no order in what? If I perform 1-4 and 2-3 moves
right.
Later on? Or?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, because these 1-4 and 2-3 moves, I mean, they don't involve any equations of motion. So, I mean, at that stage, I'm not violating any equations of motion. I mean, of course, the question is whether later on, after all these 1-4 and 2-3 moves, I can carry out further 4-1 and 3-2 moves, which then actually involve equations of motion. Whether you can always do that, at this stage, at least, I don't know. I mean,
yeah, so that
but I mean, the 1-4 and 2-3 moves, they don't involve any equations of motion. So that's why you can always carry them out.
Right, but I guess my question is, I mean, my feeling is really that you, for this framework to be kind of consistent, you need to know the whole solution. And that is the reason I think this is more like a covariant phase space. Because if you had the whole solution, then you would know how to evaluate the symplectic structure, you would know what is a maximally constrained surface, and you could go and just evaluate things there. You can calculate the reduced phase space will be perfectly fine. And then there will be extra degenerate directions in those instances of time where you have got more redundant degrees of freedom and so on. But if I think about the canonical picture, I have great difficulty in understanding what exactly is a phase space on which I got consistent dynamics, precisely because after a lot of evolution, I may have to come back and say, no, the configurations I thought were allowed are not allowed. So it seems to me that what you need is a full solution. If you have the full solution, then I know what configurations are allowed.
I agree that the full solution will essentially play a very big role. I mean, as I already said before, I mean, or if you look at some two hypersurfaces and look at a solution in between these hypersurfaces, once we have that, and it turns out that everything also with the constraints is fine, the reduced phase space from a fixed hypersurface to another fixed hypersurface will be the same. The question is just what happens if you were to evolve further than that. And that is not necessarily true that it will then be that it will be preserved. It may be, but it may not be. And in that case, it would be need to know really the full solution in order to really come with a covariant phase space, which would then be the phase space of this theory. So, but of course, then if you want to do that very generally for all sorts of triangulations, then we would have to characterize somehow our full solution space in the end with arbitrary numbers of edges involved in it. And that's one thing one can think about, but it certainly will be rather complicated. And so, I mean, it's not really that part is not really done yet. But yeah, it is true. I mean, at this stage, it seems like once you know the solution, then you know what the phase space is. Before that, I mean, one just has to live with the fact that once you, that in the course of evolution, just as we also distribute the full initial data only in the course of evolution, that likewise also some data which was initially free, was basically a free parameter, just gets fixed at some stage later on in order to have a consistent evolution.
Okay, so you agree that this is kind of is not strictly canonical in the usual sense of the word, because precisely because of the last few sentences you said.
If you look at it from that point of view, fine. Yeah, I mean, I still like to call it canonical because, I mean, we're dealing here with momenta and phase-based structures and constraints and so on. So, but okay, I mean, if you want to look at it in that way, then I guess at this stage I would have to agree.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? If not, let's thank Philippe again.